Welcome to Cisco Tech Beat, the podcast that explores the people and stories behind what inspires the newest innovation. I'm your host, AB, and I'm kicking off the 2024 season with our very own Nick Biasini, head of outreach, Cisco Talos. Cisco Talos is one of the largest commercial threat intelligence teams in the world, and they work effortlessly to safeguard Cisco clients from existing and emerging risks, identify new flaws in standard software, and neutralize threats in the wild before they inflict more damage to the broader internet. Nick, welcome to TechBeat.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You got it. As a leader in threat intelligence, the work that you and Cisco Talos do is vital in keeping our customers and, of course, Cisco safe from cyber attacks. So just for anyone listening, what does Talos do and why is threat intelligence so vital?
So Cisco Talos is the threat intelligence organization inside of Cisco. The easiest way to think about us is if you have a Cisco security product and it blocks something, it's most likely because of our group. We're a team of researchers, you know, reversers, programmers that basically spend our days scouring over the malicious activity that's going on the internet. More broadly, what it means by threat intelligence is not just detection of files as good or bad, but having an understanding of how the adversaries are operating on the landscape, what are the indicators and TTPs that you need to be aware of, and how do we work to stay ahead of all of the bad activity that's going on the internet. There we go.
Got it. And it's interesting because you mentioned that there are several different kinds of folks working within Cisco Talos. Mm-hmm. Just again, what are some of the variety of positions that we would find in the Talos org?
Ooh, that's a tough one. It runs the full gamut, right? We're obviously skewed a tad disproportionately on the technical side of the house, especially from a security perspective. We got folks who can take malware apart, can analyze malware, but we also have folks that understand how computers work, how systems work. We also have folks who write code. That's their primary job. We have folks who are charged with doing big data analytics and kind of play around in massive data sets. We have linguists. We have all kinds of stuff. And that beside all of the administrative staff that also exists inside of our organization, we basically run the full gambit. The one commonality is we love what we do. We're passionate about security. And, you know, this is kind of what we just enjoy doing.
I love it. And just a note to anyone out there listening who's interested in cybersecurity in general, you notice that there are lots of different roles within the field. So just another reminder that, you know, you can really go in any direction as long as you've got passion about cybersecurity. I want to talk about the end of last year, because not long before we finished 2023, Cisco Talos released its year in review, which is essentially a list of some of the top trends that were seen in 2023. Now, just to get this right, I want to make sure, because the three of the ones that stood out were ransomware, commodity loaders, and advanced persistent threats, or what we call APTs. So would you mind describing what each of these is? Maybe follow up with why you think those particularly dominated the threat landscape.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll start with ransomware. I like to kind of broaden ransomware to include the data extortion activity that we're seeing a lot of. But what's interesting about the ransomware landscape this year or this past year is the fact that it's kind of splitting. We're seeing kind of two divergent paths. So you have these very large groups that are conducting these very widespread, large campaigns against big targets that are increasingly focused on data exfiltration and that side of extortion. On the other side, you have all of these kind of small groups that are starting to pop up all over the place that are using these leaked builders and open source and various other types of source code leaks to build their own ransomware capabilities. These groups are targeting smaller businesses and tend to not care about data exfiltration at all. They're much more purely focused on the ransomware play. And it's important because it's affecting basically everyone on the planet right now.
Yeah.
As far as commodity loaders, that actually ties in nicely with the ransomware and data extortion side of the house. What this basically refers to are those big, widespread malware families that you commonly are familiar with. Things like Quackbot, Trickbot, IcedID, those types of things. Those types of threats are incredibly important as facilitators for larger attacks. So in the past, These are primarily things like banking trojans, right?
Right.
But today, they're primarily used as an initial access point for these ransomware cartels and extortion groups, where instead of having to compromise the victim directly, they basically just work with these other groups and are able to get access that's already existing. Mm. Now, that's important because it affects a huge swath of enterprises and general people on the internet. Now, right. The final group there, the advanced persistent threats, this is basically your state-sponsored groups. So this is your Lazarus. This is all your famous APT groups out of Russia and out of China and these other state-sponsored organizations that are out there doing activities tend to be focused on the espionage side of the house. But with, unfortunately, the geopolitical things that are going on, we're seeing more cyber war style activity primarily originating out of Russia.
It sounds like, you know, whereas maybe in the past, many targets would have been large agencies or large corporations. Now, I mean, pretty much anyone is getting affected by cyber threats. You could just be an individual shopping online and they're going to target you just as readily as a large corporation.
Yeah, the problem right now is there's just so much money being made. These ransomware cartels and extortion cartels are pulling in millions and millions of dollars. And when you start doing that, criminals definitely stand up at attention. And we're right. definitely seeing more and more folks kind of fall into that line of activity.
Scary stuff, but that's why we have Cisco Talos working hard to make sure that they're not successful. One of the more troubling data points from the review indicated that the healthcare industry was the most targeted industry when it comes to cyber attacks or cyber threats. Mm-hmm. And that's particularly disturbing because obviously that can directly affect the health, maybe even the life of an individual, a patient who gets sick in a hospital and then the hospital shuts down, whatever the scenario is. What is it that makes the healthcare industry the biggest target? And what can healthcare professionals do to try to make sure that their institutions are more secure against cyber attacks?
Well, actually, you hit the nail on the head already. The reason why they're being so heavily targeted is the nature of what they do. People's lives are on the line, potentially, in these attacks. And as such, they are very, very, very highly motivated to pay. And these adversaries, these cartels, are out here to make money. So if they have a particular vertical that they know is highly motivated to pay, they are going to attack it a lot because that's how they make their money, unfortunately. There isn't an easy solution out there. The biggest things that healthcare providers can do is make sure you have security technologies in place. And I can't emphasize this enough. Make sure you have your security basics covered. You need to be able to do things like network segmentation, access control, asset identification, patching. These things are going to be the things that save you when these groups come knocking. Because unfortunately, we have to be right 100% of the time. Offenders just have to get lucky once. We got to be right every time. So when that bad one thing gets missed and the bad guys get in, it's those basics that are going to save you.
That's such a great advice. And sort of to piggyback on that, one of the other things I read in the review is that it's not just software. A lot of people think, oh, you know, someone's going to write code and they're going to kind of get in through some software avenue. But there's hardware consideration as well as far as legacy products, things that haven't been updated. I wonder if we could just touch quickly upon why it's so important to have hardware that is also resilient and not, you know, not easily accessible.
Well, you hit the point there with making sure that you can update things. The age of your hardware will likely indicate how frequent you're going to get software updates. And let's be honest, if you have a piece of hardware that's been running for 10 years, it is highly unlikely that it is patched for a lot of things out there. So even if it's not exposed to the internet, if an adversary is able to get inside your network, they're going to find these devices, they're going to leverage them against you, and they're going to figure out ways to further their attacks with them. So it is very important to make sure your hardware and your software is supported and is as up to date as it possibly can be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's jump into AI because everybody else is doing it. Obviously, before 2023 came to an end, AI was the big talk and still is the big talk of the town throughout all industries for the most part. And of course, at Cisco, we are looking at ways to leverage AI to really benefit the end customer experience, right? Now, with regard to AI and security, cybersecurity, What are your thoughts in general on how it plays a role in the kind of work that Talos does and just in the industry in general?
So the basic way that I look at AI is it makes people better. So if you have a security analyst and you want to make them better, giving them AI will help them be a better security analyst. Unfortunately, the same thing is true with criminals. So if you have a criminal that is already in the cyber crime landscape, this will make them better at what they do. It's not going to create overnight. It's not going to create like 1,000 new attackers. None of that is going to happen. And it's actually very difficult to see how AI is being used, because for the most part, it's going to be small things in the background. It's going to be, I need a better lure. I need something that's written a little bit cleaner. I need to figure out why I can't make this particular function work in this program I'm writing. AI can help you solve those questions. What it's not going to do is build an entire cybercrime infrastructure for you and launch attacks. So it is absolutely going to have impacts, but it's going to be subtle. It's going to make average adversaries into very sophisticated adversaries very quickly. Those are going to be the types of changes you're going to see. It's going to be very hard to say this attack was powered by AI, because honestly, you have no idea what little tips and tidbits they're pulling along the way that's being aided by AI or more generally by LLMs or ChatGPT.
Sure, sure. And I think to your point, really the focus is, listen, how do we use AI for the good? You know, I mean, people will use whatever technology is available for the bad, but we need to use it to counter that and to sort of prevent things from happening before they happen.
Absolutely. That's a really good call out too, is the access to this is democratic. So if you're a bad guy or a good guy, you both can benefit from it. So that, at least in that, it should theoretically be a wash, because whatever gains they make on the bad side, we're going to make concurrent gains on the good side.
Right. Exactly. People, listen, AI is good, and we're going to use it to our best ability at Cisco to make your experience safe, secure, and hopefully user-friendly. I want to touch back on something you mentioned a little while ago about geopolitical instability. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we know there are lots of unfortunate events happening around the world, and I'm wondering, how does that affect the way that Cisco Talos would mitigate problems or sort of, you know, catch things? Is there a relationship between geopolitical instability and cybersecurity? And what are you seeing and how do you deal with it?
Absolutely. There are a bunch of different ways that geopolitical events can affect the cybersecurity landscape. The most broad of which is from a lure perspective. This is a global event that's happening that affects and is known by basically everyone on the planet. It creates an incredibly effective lure set for actors to use, both inside the region and outside the region. So that is probably the first and foremost way that you see impacts. Second is, none of this activity occurs in a vacuum, and there is no honor amongst thieves, meaning the techniques and the things that we see being used in the battleground, if they're effective, will quickly be picked up by other adversaries around the planet and used outside of those kind of conflict zones, for lack of a better term. So that is one of the big takeaways you can do, is we will glean detection capabilities based on what we're seeing there, because we know that those impacts are eventually going to be felt in other regions of the world. And then for customers, the most important thing you can do is learn how you may be kind of unexpectedly impacted. So looking at do you have facilities or offices in those areas? Do you depend on vendors who are also located or depend on resources in those areas? Those groups are going to be impacted. And if you do have assets in the region, making sure that you have extra security protection on that traffic, on those systems, is very important. Because if you are going to be impacted, it's more likely that the attacks are going to originate, or the access is going to originate from that region of the world. So being skeptical of those resources, making sure you're doing the proper things from a security perspective, applying defense in depth, all those things are going to make a difference in the end.
Wow. That's a really interesting perspective too, because I didn't think about the sort of the tangential effects, you know, and I get the lure thing is like something big's happening. Everyone's attracted to it. There's a lot of talk about it. There are a lot of things happening around it. But then of course, within that region, there are things, you know, it's like the, what is it, the security poverty line. The weakest link is like, you got to get rid of the weakest link in the security chain. And of course, if you're tied to this other industry or something else and they get hacked. I mean, it's like a logarithmic type of thing.
Yeah, you never know. There are times, like even in the Ukraine conflict, there was weird cascading effects because there are manufacturing that only happens in Ukraine that cascades into other verticals that you wouldn't even know is an issue. You won't know until there's an issue in the region, and then all of a sudden all of your supplies dry up. That's the type of thing that you want to make sure that you're ahead of.
Got it. Stay alert. Stay alert. Be alert. Want to talk beyond AI for a second, just going back a couple questions. We know that AI is certainly going to play a role in how we fortify our cybersecurity practices. Looking ahead, I mean, we're at the beginning of the year, essentially. We have a whole year ahead of us and a bright future in general. Are there other trends that you think are going to be on the horizon, or are you seeing anything that might play a role in the work that you and Cisco Talos do and just the cybersecurity realm in general?
So there's one in particular that I want to highlight, and then this is kind of a late, more recent breaking thing. We've started to see some of the social engineering focused groups. So think like your Lapsus, those types of groups that are kind of referred to generally as Scattered Spider or the Calm. They are starting to make inroads with ransomware groups. And that sets a really, really dangerous precedent. I actually think that in 2024, ransomware and extortion cartels are going to lean heavier and heavier on social engineering tactics. Things like SIM swapping, things that the Calm does very, very well, are going to play a bigger and bigger role in the threat landscape. And it's unfortunately an area where we have very, very hard times defending, especially when you start talking about individuals. It's not a technology problem.
Right.
It's a people problem. So it becomes a much, much harder challenge to face. The other thing that I think garners attention, and it's something that we've been focused on for a while and will be a bigger issue in 2024 and beyond, is the private sector offensive actors and mercenary spyware. This is an incredibly, incredibly important space. Although it does not affect large swaths of the internet, it's a highly, highly targeted attack. The folks that are being attacked and targeted tend to be activists, dissidents, and journalists. It's incredibly important that we don't lose sight of what's going on with these individuals and how crucial it is that we protect these groups for just the sanctity of governments around the world.
Wow. And so, for example, attacking a journalist in some fashion, could you just give an example of what that might look like and what the ramifications of that would be?
Yeah, absolutely. So in a lot of these cases, we see journalists being attacked to expose their sources. So if you think about, unfortunately, there are areas of the world where governments are authoritarian, where people are taking huge risk by speaking out actively against the governments that may be in charge. And by attacking these journalists, theoretically, these people's lives could be put in danger because they're now potentially able to expose the sources that journalists take incredible lengths to keep private and out of the public eye could potentially be exposed. And that's just one example of the types of targeting that can go on in this space. It's a very dangerous, dangerous space, especially since there's very little protections. I mean, these attacks are using 0 days. In some cases, they're using 0 clicks to where there is literally no defense against it. It's a very, very tough problem to tackle.
Wow. I mean, it's almost like a Mission Impossible movie, like when somebody steals the knock list, you know, so that they can identify, you know, operatives around the world. I mean, I imagine that that's been happening anyway, but that's obviously a danger to those individuals too.
Yeah, the one advantage is you're talking 6 or 7 figure cost to use these types of utilities. So it's not something that your average person is going to be concerned with. But if you are someone who is of interest of a government, that's just pennies to a government. Yeah. It seems like a lot to you and me and to the private sector, but for a nation, that is a rounding error and nothing more than that.
Got it. Which is interesting because it sounds like pretty much, and I guess this would be the point when you hack it nowadays, but extortion, is it just about the bottom line? Like people just want money? Is that 95% of it? I don't know what the statistic is.
In the grants, there's kind of is two wide groups of activity. So you mentioned APTs. Those are your state sponsored groups. They're going to be more like espionage, more type of spy versus spy type of activity. But the overwhelming majority of it is purely financial. Crimeware makes up just massive percentage of the overall activity. It's almost to the point where the state sponsored APT stuff is just like a small sliver in the overall crimeware landscape, because there's just so much money to be made right now.
Right. The other point that you made too, that I want to just reiterate or just discuss a little bit more, is the social engineering. Because if for anyone out there, and please make sure my definition is more accurate when you describe it, but essentially that's using day-to-day activities and things that don't even require necessarily, you know, code and getting into a computer. I mean, that's, like you said, SIM swapping or even a conversation. What defines social engineering, and how can people better protect themselves or be aware of what might be happening to them?
So the easiest thing to look at it is, when we look at security, we look at finding weaknesses, right? Most of our focus is on technological weaknesses, vulnerabilities, things like that. These are also weaknesses, but they're weaknesses in people. And it's a completely different skill set. So think about it like the con man of days gone by. It's the same type of idea. If they can get you on the phone, they can figure out a way to talk you into doing what they want. They're either going to threaten you and say, you need to do this or else, or they're going to come up with a sob story and be like, please, because humans generally want to do two things. They're inquisitive and they want to help. And because of that, social engineers are incredibly effective at figuring out ways to use that against you. They're going to come up. I mean, I've done research into some of these campaigns with like the business email compromise. They had people pretending to be executives at cancer wards with terminal patients, asking them that they need to buy things so that they can give them to terminal cancer patients. There is no bottom for what these people are willing to do to get them to give you money. And that's something that just you can't emphasize enough.
Yeah. And I think you make a great point about just them doing it in any number of ways. I mean, and I think even I have started to think about things differently. For example, when I get these random texts about, you know, do you want to sell your house? You know, on the surface, it could look like, oh, maybe a realtor had the wrong info, which you kind of figure out after the third time it's not that. But something like that could even be, these errant texts that you get could really be a fishing expedition, right?
That's a big thing now. They call it pig butchering. I don't know why they call it that, but that's what it's called. Basically, you'll get these texts like, hey, I got a new phone and this number's in it. Who is this? Or, hey, I'm not sure who this number is. Like, who are you? Like, those types of texts, their goal is to strike up a conversation with you. So over time, eventually, they'll try and scam you. But they're willing to put in weeks, if not longer time periods, trying to get to these points. And you'll see it a lot, too, in romance scams. So a lot of people will pretend to show romantic interest in people to try and scam them out of things. That also is incredibly prevalent right now.
Oof. Scary stuff. Scary stuff. I want to switch gears completely. First of all, I'll say this. To be up and attacking these attackers, you got to be awake, which means you got to drink some coffee. And I'm specifically mentioning coffee because I know you love coffee. You're very passionate about it. I enjoy coffee every day myself. But what is your passion? Like, what, first of all, what's your go-to blend? And what is it about coffee that's so special for you?
So for me, blends are entirely a no-go. I'm single origin coffee only as far as my coffee tastes go. My coffee escapades are pretty significant. I roast my own coffee at home. I basically exclusively make pour overs. So I'm hand making every cup of coffee I make every day when I have a cup of coffee. Particularly, I like single origin coffee because you can start pulling through flavor notes. So as you get more sophisticated into coffee and you start appreciating the various regions around the world, you can start tasting the differences between coffees that are grown in South America and Central America versus Asia versus Africa. You really start to get more of a deep appreciation, not just for the actual coffee, but in the preparation associated with it. So like, I love coffee that's single origin, that is dried with fruit, that is a particular like of mine. It imparts great flavor into the coffee and really makes it stand out. But yeah, it's a huge passion of mine.
That's amazing. What does that roasting process look like? At least the way you do it.
So I have a small personal roaster that's an air roaster that I use, but there's actually a lot of variety in that as well. One of the things that is most well known about it is you can actually get the old stovetop popcorn makers and actually use that to roast coffee. So there's a lot of people out there that use that as like an entry point, because then you don't have to buy anything. It's like a $10 thing that you can sometimes find at like thrift stores that you can go and use for that. But yeah, for me, I have an air roaster. There's also drum roasting. You can do small batch, which is what I do because I'm not crazy, or you can start getting much, much bigger. And then they have big intermediate size drum roasters, and then the big, big giant drum roasters, which is what your coffee shops typically use.
So that's a follow-up question. What's the best cup of coffee you've ever had, and where was that?
Well, I have two answers. So the best initial cup of coffee I ever had was at a steakhouse in the Bay Area where I actually had Kopi Luwak for the first time. For those of you that aren't aware, Kopi Luwak is like a famous coffee because it is grown in Indonesia, is eaten by a civet, and then digested. And then there are people who basically walk around the forest picking up coffee beans off the ground, and then they wash, clean, and roast it. That is probably one of the most interesting and without a doubt the most expensive cup of coffee I ever had. I didn't pay for it myself. The other one that I've had that stands out to me is actually my favorite coffee roaster from Las Vegas, because I go to Black Hat and DEF CON and Cisco Live often. I end up spending a lot of time in Las Vegas over the last decade. I found a particular coffee roaster that is very good called Vesta, and they do a lot of fruit drying in their coffee, which really imparts incredible tastes. And it's one of my favorite coffee places to go to in the US, at least.
That's amazing. Yeah, next time I'm out there for maybe Cisco Live or one of those other events, I will definitely check them out. I'm always looking for a good cup of coffee. And I find like it's easier to find great coffee outside of New York City proper. I'm just letting you know there are some good places, but typically you have to kind of know where to go. But so it's nice to hear that Vegas, which has a lot of other stuff going on, has some good coffee to find. So
there is actually a really good coffee roaster inside of Brooklyn that is the name of which is escaping me right now. But they're actually very cool in that they grow African varietals of coffee in South America. So it's a completely unique aspect because they're taking all of the lineage from Africa, but growing in a different region of the world. It's pretty cool.
Wow. That's cool. Well, Nick, thank you so much for doing the first podcast, the first Tech Meet episode of 2024. I really, really appreciate it. And for highlighting, you know, not just the trends that we saw in the past, but thinking ahead about what the security landscape can and will look like and what people can do to better protect themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Me too. Take care.